CosmicRadio.tv. This podcast would be nothing without our patrons, so special thanks goes out to them. Want to join their ranks and support independent content? Head to our Patreon at patreon.com/8bitlife. Welcome to the fine edition of my so-called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Vaz. Joining me today, Mr. Bill Meeks.
How's it going, sir? It's been a while.
It has been a while, and it's going good. You've been busy, but it's funny because you have been my recent window into Orlando and into Disney World. Out of boredom, And as I plan trips, I get like, oh, hey, you know, maybe I could do another trip someplace else. I started looking into how much it would cost to get a season pass to Disney World.
Mm-hmm. It's not cheap.
No, it's not.
Especially for a family of five like I have.
Do you have a season pass to Disney World?
We did. Sorry, I was fixing my mic there. We did. It just ran out last weekend, I think.
Oh, so interesting.
We had one for a year. And we went about 60,000 times. We got our money out of that sucker because it was a lot of money. So,
okay, this is something I've got to ask because I'm so curious about this damn fucking badge. And the only reason I'm curious because it's I think at one point Adafruit had an article, or Adafruit did, or some either one of the breakdown things where they took apart the wristband, the magic band. Yeah. Are you looking for your magic band?
Yeah, I was straight. I know the box was out here last weekend, but I think it's been put away now, so I can't pull out my magic band set.
Okay, so how does that work? Like, what use do you get out of this? And I realize it's like, why am I asking on this? I'm just curious. I'm so fascinated because I've never lived in a town that has like a giant fucking amusement park. Like, and yes, Six Flags is in San Antonio, and yes, I get season pass for that. But this is fucking Disney World. This is where you could go and say like, you know what? I want to go to Epcot and let me go look at some animals and fuck it. Let me go around the world really quick.
Yeah. As far as the magic band, it works as your ticket to get into the park. You don't have to carry a card around with you. You just, there's like these little globes with a green Mickey head on them and you stick your wrist up to it and then it spins around and then a white light shines and you're good to go. So it works for admission and then it works for the fast passes, which you get, I think, 3 fast passes every day, I think it is. And you set it up through the app. My wife always did the app stuff. So then when you walk onto the ride, when you get into the fast pass line, you just, again, scan the thing and they let you ride on through. And if you're staying at one of the resorts, you can actually link it up to your credit card to where you don't have to take anything with you. And you can just pay with that, which I never wanted to do.
Yeah, that was the, when I read that, I was like, that's like the, like if Disney dollars is here, mm-hmm. in the I won't care, I don't perceive this as real money. Mm-hmm. That's the dangerous level, like that's up to there. Yeah. Like that's like a like not even like the next step. It's like the next evolution of like not paying attention to any funds while I'm in this magical world.
Yeah, and of course they also use it to track you as you go around the park because there's a short range RFID in it and a long range RFID in it. So they can basically track your movements around the park, see where you go, see how long you're waiting in lines, and tabulate things based on that. And then they started doing this when we were about 6 months in on the pass. They've started doing these really creepy things where like. And it's a small world. At the end, you drive by these signs that are like, goodbye in all these different languages. Now it says goodbye, Bill, because it reads your name off the badge.
Oh, my God. That's too much.
Yeah.
It's a small world knowing my existence. I don't want to have, it's a place of wonder, Roberto, and a place of, like, no, that's demon talk right there.
Especially if you're stuck in that last room for 10 minutes, like, I'll. To happen because the boats get backed up.
Oh God! I think there was a report a couple of years back where there was a guy I think he was, I don't remember. I know he was, he had some sort of, injury of some sort where basically he was just, he couldn't leave the ride somehow. Someone forgot him. Something happened. I forget the exact reason.
I remember this story vaguely,
but I think it was, he was stuck on the ride for like at least, you know, I don't remember how many rotation it was. It was enough where if you read it and you've ever been on that ride, you understand. So for those, what I'm talking about, to make a quick example, out of all the rides in Disney World that I've ever had the honor of being on, or not honor of being on, It's a Small World might be the one I hate the most, because I think it comes from an era where I think it was important. Like, I think it was an important thing of like when It's a Small World happened, was the idea of like, the world's kind of, you know, in the end of it all, there's really not a whole lot. I do enjoy the song. I enjoy the sentiment of It's a Small World song. I think it's a good song. I think it's a cool message to have. You know, it's a world of wonder, in a world of laughter, a world of fun. All this sort of the idea of like, you know, as much difference as we have in the world, we're all kind of roughly the same. We're all these, you know, carbon-based life forms and have to deal with shit. That being said, it's also an annoying song after a while. And I can only imagine after you like the, you know, first, you know, the second or third time of hearing It's a World of like, you just want to scream and like kill somebody or kill yourself. And just, you know, you're contemplating suicide after the fifth round. Like, well, no one's saving me. The only way out is, there's only one way out of this ride.
It's not that bad unless you get caught in that last room, because it varies up, because the musical style changes, the language changes as you go through the ride and go through all the different countries. But if you get stuck in one, oh my God, that is awful.
Because it's just this loop. It's this loop of like the same song. And again, I think it's a cool concept. I will never say it's not a cool concept. But after that many hours of dealing with that, and it's not an exciting ride. It's not like there's, it's not like Splash Mountain. It's not like those sort of things where there's like that. Or it's not even like what was the ride that was in Epcot that they end up getting rid of?
Maybe there's several.
It was like the LED light show of craziness. It's like Space Mountain or something.
No, Space Mountain's the coaster in Magic Kingdom.
Okay. Then yeah, Space Mountain's one I'm thinking of. Then I think
it's a coaster in Magic Kingdom. It's all dark, but there are, you know, star, like a star dome, and then lights on the coasters.
Yeah, that's one I'm thinking of. Sorry, like it's not like that. Like that's at least somewhat fun, because it's like, well, if I'm stuck on this coaster, I mean, at least it's like cool lights and there's motion and stuff. Like, no, it's just like, you know, it's not even like it's not even a level like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride where it's just like, oh, kind of sort of hops. Like at least that I think I could deal with. Mm-hmm. Like if I had to be caught in one of the rides, but just this like endless loop of like going that, or I don't even know if the ride still exists in Epcot where it's like they're like, I think it was like a whole bunch of holograms or something like that projected on something. I forget what. I was like, it wasn't quite like the Roll of Tomorrow, but it was some like ride where it's just like, and here's the history of something or another. And I remember I wrote it. It's just like, I'm not really learning anything.
I can't think of anything with holograms. Maybe you're talking about Spaceship Earth, because that kind of takes you through the history of humans on Earth.
Maybe it's Spaceship Earth I'm thinking of, because like, and not because they're not important rides. This is where we get that, is because after certain points, like I've already grasped this information. I already know what you're trying to tell me. If I have to hear this again, I will kill something, you know, and if the only way for me to survive is to eat this arm off, then so be it.
Well, I'm just going to say there's a pretty good reason why we didn't renew our passes, because, you know, we got our money's worth out of them. We went to Disney almost every weekend for the entire year. But after going that much, you're like, OK, I think I've seen what I need to see here.
I imagine so. That's kind of what I gathered, was that after a certain point, like here's the question I'll ask you. What rides in Disney World, after all many times you and your kids went, and your kids are probably the better barometer of this, but yeah, I bet you even you have some theories, some thoughts, and some ideas. What are the rides you're sick and tired of at Disney World that most people enjoy?
Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. Just because I'm a huge coaster fan, and it was great the first 30 times I went on it. But after that, it was just like, okay, when we first started going, it was like, okay, we can go into like Carousel of Progress and take a little nap, a little rest. By the time it was done, it was Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. Sweet. I get to just kick back and like close.
Oh my God. That's great. That's see, the thing is that like, I think during the season pass, I would start screwing with things. And knowing that they were tracking my data and like tracking my position, I think I would say, you know what? I'm going to be that one random variable outlier that's going to be like, well, this guy is like really weird. He's riding all these interesting rides, but for some reason he's like spending like 3 hours on the teacups. And we don't know why he's spending 3 hours on the teacups. just add some bizarro data set information to it.
Well, the teacups are pretty sweet, man. Sweet. And 9 times out of 10, when you come off them, Alice and the Mad Hatter are right there.
I guess that's true. I would take that year and do stuff, or even better yet, just like, so where is Mr. Meeks if we want to track him? Well, he's been on the monorail for the past 5 hours, not really getting off. He's just riding the monorail. He's still alive. He's still conversing. In fact, him and his family are having a really good time. It's just they seem to be spending hours and hours on the monorail. You know, just some bizarre, like just like some weird data set. Just like when you look at the activity, it's like you spent 5 hours on the monorail and didn't get off. You earned the prize or something. I would have fun with the data set at least. But it's a pretty expensive like set for that reason.
Yeah, if you're paying to go for a day, yeah, you don't want to do that stuff. But with an annual pass, you can do that. We really didn't do too much of that. What we would do is we would try and hit as many rides as humanly possible while we were there. And sometimes it was very successful. Sometimes it was not. But we often had help from a mutual friend of ours who works there, who would, if we went at the end of the month, he would hand us a stack of paper fast passes.
Ah,
and then we would just live like kings.
I think I know said mutual friend. I assume, and that's good to know, because I mean typically when I go to Disney World, and I've only been there like a handful of times. I've been wanting to kind of go back, and nothing badly.
Sunburn over in your chat room here says, pop quiz, after 28 years of operation, Walt Disney World closed its doors for the first time. Name the event that caused the parks to shut down. 9/11.
Yes.
I believe.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, because I've read stories about people who were there that day about, you know, them being ushered out of the park and everything like that.
Well, because, like, and I've never confirmed this myth, and I need to double check it, but I've always heard the myth that...
Not 9/11. Whoa.
Well, maybe it's closed twice now. I'm going to say the Hurricane Floyd. That's what it was.
That makes sense.
But going back to what was I say? I've always wondered, especially when it comes like to Disney World, just like all those sort of things, like how where the advantage of a season pass comes in for those things, because it's just like I haven't been there in a while, and I know that's like cool. I get to go and have fun and do the stuff.
So the advantage for me was just being able to not have to rush any, because I had been there a couple times, just solo 1 day trips for various kids' birthdays and stuff. And it always felt like we were rushed and we were trying to do as much as possible. And the season pass, if nothing else, it was just nice to know you had plenty of time and plenty of access to go do whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted.
Well, especially if you live there. I mean, if you live there, and that's always been my crux of like looking at that. Like, well, if I lived in Orlando, I probably would get a season pass at least one time.
Yeah.
If nothing more than to experience that, because again, I like the idea of the magic of that pass, first and foremost, like the idea of just like boop and getting in and showing like, hi, I'm special and I get to come in here. But I mean, of course, you're still competing depending on the season of like how many people are there and everything else. And so I would almost utilize it as that and to kind of go every so often, because again, you'd have to go like you and your family did, where it's just like, go, you know, this is our mission to go, not just to get the value out of it, but just, you know, anytime the kid's like, you want to do something fun, it's like, yeah, let's go to Disney World, cool, you know. And we could just kind of, I think that's the convenient of the lure of it is just the you kids want to go to Disney World? Yeah. All right, let's go.
What else was really nice about it, too, was, you know, so many people come down here for vacations and to visit Orlando and stuff. And specifically, a lot of our podcast listeners, we got to end up meeting up with down there, going out for a meal, going on some rides together. So it was just like a really nice central meeting spot for our community. You know, it's someplace they were already going anyway.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's funny because it's something people are coming to go like for me, usually when I get to meet people in the community for, you know, the various podcasts I work on or stuff like that, it's at South By. Yeah, South By becomes my like de facto, like, cool, everyone's here, everyone's in town now. Or you know, and it's or RTX or some big thing happening in Austin. So I can imagine like Disney World, like during the summer, it's like, yeah, we're going to Disney World, which I want to go back one of these years. I just need to plan it because I've every time I look at that, and I look at just, again, it just because I'll see you mention a season pass or somebody else, I'm like, you know, let me look into this. I'm curious as to what it would take to do so. I have no desire to do so, but I also say, like, well, how much would it cost to go to Disney World? Like, what is the budget of that? You know, how much is it? You know, well, in the grand scheme of things, obviously, if you're a family of four, it can be costly, but mm-hmm. it's not that much more costly than any other trip, I think.
Very true. Very. And if I was just solo guy running out there doing my own thing, it would be very affordable. Like, yeah, it wouldn't have put a dent in my wallet at all. You know, with a family of five, it's a little bit of a dent, just a little bit. But it was
well, yeah. I mean, the question goes, and I guess this is where you start. What I've learned over after planning a certain trip, is. It's understanding that you can probably do one of these once a year, maybe twice, maybe once every 2 years, and then budget accordingly. In other words, like, hey, kids, we're gonna go to Disney World during this month. And it's like, okay, well, how much money will it take to do it? And the beauty part about Disney World, the only reason I bring it up, much like a lot of these destination places, Disney World, Universal Studios, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, a lot of them have, like, these tour packages where you can, like, you know, flight, you know, where it's like hotel and this sort of stuff included, and all you need is the flight, and you know, you can kind of figure that stuff out, because ultimately they, you know, they want your business, they want you there, because you're not going to spend money simply on, you know, it's not going to be like, oh, look, you got a ticket and whatever. That's like, that's not where the park makes. I mean, they make a good chunk of money there, but they don't make all their money that way. Like the money, the way, you know, it's going in saying like, I want to buy that t-shirt, let me get some butterbeer, you know, or your Disney World, like, let me get the mouse here, you know, all the other crap that gets attached to Disney World, you know.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I will say, though, it's very nice just to have a place as a family to go every weekend. If you don't have anything else to do, you have somewhere you can go. You get out, you get some good exercise, you ride some rides. I mean, before we got the Disney World passes, when we lived in Atlanta, for about a year and a half, we had Six Flags Over Georgia passes, and those were really nice. And now that we're done with the Disney World passes, we picked up, and it's less than half of what we were paying for the Disney World passes, plus a bunch of free perks like free beer every time you go to the park and stuff. We got SeaWorld Aquatica Busch Gardens passes.
Oh, and interesting.
So that's been pretty nice. So that's the plan. We're done with Disney for now. We're doing SeaWorld this year. And then next year we're going to do Universal. And then the year after that, after they put in all the new stuff at Disney, we'll go back.
I think that's smart. I think that's the way you... I mean, you're lucky that you're at a place that is a destination town, you know, for that kind of stuff, that you can kind of cycle between those three. And I think that's the smart idea is to kind of get the advantage of like, well, cool, we spent a year at Disney World, you know, and we a year meaning like whatever the season is. And you've looked at everything, you've ridden everything, you've experienced, you know, you've had, you know, countless amount of food and whatnot. You've done all the things that you wanted to do at Disney World, you know, for a good chunk of time until it's like, hey, we have a new ride. Or it's like, look, everybody, it is Zootopia Land's opened up or whatever, Marvel Land or, you know, I mean, once Star Wars Land opens up, like, Bill, I have a feeling you're like, we're getting season pass now because I want to spend my life here.
Not with Star Wars, because I'm not a huge Star Wars fan. The kids are, though, so they're going to be all over it. Gotcha. Me, I'm more Toy Story Land.
Okay, that's fair.
But yeah, no, it kind of felt like an honor because, I mean, when I was growing up, yeah, Disney World was just so out of the realm of possibility. I grew up pretty poor and in a pretty poor area and stuff. So only rich people went to Disney World, you know, and now I've been to Disney World probably more than anyone I know, except for other people who live around here.
I would say same thing because like Disney, like even I didn't necessarily grow up poor per se, but Disney World was that, like, again, grew up in Michigan. It's not, it still takes, you know, and you know, my dad being in a profession that, not that he couldn't take time off, it became harder to take time off as a doctor, medical, you know, for certain things like that, that it became this thing, like, we'd have to plan that trip. We'd have to sort of figure it out and adjust accordingly. And like, I've only been to Disney World, like I said, like in my entire life twice. Mm-hmm. And in both, and I've been since. I've wanted to go as a kind of adult just to sort of experience it again. But
yeah, honestly, if 8-year-old me knew how many times I've been to theme parks in the past 3 years between Six Flags and Disney World, he would say, shut the fuck up.
No, for me, if a high school me knew exactly where I was going in the next 2 weeks, he'd be just as excited as Kurt me is.
Where are you going in the next 2 weeks?
I'm going to Japan. I've been talking about this like for a long time. I'm going like in Japan in September. Nice. Yeah, I'll daily record some stuff while I'm there and go from there. But we should switch topics. We've been talking about Disney World for like way too fucking long. And in the pre-show,
I will say before we move on from Disney World, I had a great time reconnecting with our mutual friends Brian Brushwood and Justin Robert Young there a couple weekends ago.
Yeah, I heard they were in town and that they all went to Disney World and experienced all the fun that is Epcot and is it at Epcot where it's the drink around the world competition or something like that? Epcot,
on the World Showcase, they have like every country, not every country in the world, obviously, but all right. The big ones. And you just go around and you get, you know, a glass of wine in this country and then a beer in this country and, you know, whatever's appropriate for the
country. What was your, and I know I want to switch off, but I'm very curious because you've been there many times. What was your strategy in Epcot when it came to accomplishing around the world stuff? Because I imagine that there are times where you and the wife just went to Epcot and just like, you know what, we're here, it's Friday night, it's our date night, so to speak, let's just drink around the world. Like, what was your strategy on that, if you had one?
Well, honestly, when Justin and Brian were there, it was my first time doing the whole drink around the world thing. We'd been to, had date nights there, but we didn't do the drink around the world thing. We would walk around the world, we would grab a drink here or there. But yeah, as far as strategy for drinking at Epcot, my strategy involves taking a non-clear water bottle as big as possible and filling it with red wine and drinking on that before I buy anything. That was my strategy because they'll never check what's in it at the security line or anything. So you can take your own booze in and, you know, pregame while you're walking around the park. And then, you know, just keep yourself topped off with a beer every hour or so.
That's wow. Okay. There's your pro, your Disney World pro tip.
They will never check what's in your water bottle.
Pretty soon they'll start doing that. But even with that said, like I imagine, especially Epcot being the, like, you started having places where you'd want to go eat first,
Definitely. We've tried several places there and it was always really good. I think it's the Rose and Crown or the Rose and Thorn pub in the UK is really good. They have really good burgers and fish and chips and all that. There's Spice Road Table in Morocco, which has really good hummus, and I'm a huge hummus fan. And I'm trying to. We did our first date night when we went there. We went in France. There's a kind of family dining French restaurant, and then like a really super duper upper class, cost way too much kind of French restaurant. And we went there. And that was really good. It was really expensive. And we felt like dummies the entire time because neither of us had ever been to a French restaurant before.
Right.
We were like, how do we eat this? You know, all that kind of stuff. But so that was really good. But I mean, really, especially when we were traveling with the kids, what's the name of the electric umbrella, which right when you walk into Epcot, it's just basically like a fast food joint. They have burgers, chicken nuggets, stuff like that. We'd always end up going there because the kids wanted to eat there, right. And we need to eat something there. So
yeah, no, and I think that's what I always enjoyed about, like, specifically Epcot, was that the idea behind it, and that you had all these different kind of restaurants that were there. There were different world cuisines, and you could argue, like, well, it's not this, like there's all that argument, but as years have gone on, you know, because both prices have increased, but also, you know, expectations of goers of Disney World has raised. A lot of those restaurants have, like, well, we've hired, like, you know, sommeliers that know what the hell are talking about. We've hired, you know, that, like, my brother always talks about friends of his that have been, like, hired by those kind of places. They're like sommeliers for Disney World. And that's like a high praise, because, you know, he's like, you have to make the wine list for this place. And because you don't know who's going to come through, it's not going to be just like, oh, I don't know anything about wine. It could be someone like, I know exactly what I want. And, you know, I mean, it's like, well, here's our giant list of stuff. And it becomes an interesting kind of, you know, thing.
I will say that, you know, the Food and Wine Festival they have at Epcot, that's where it's at. Because, I mean, it all takes place in the World Showcase, but they just have all these little booths with just, like, it's like tapas or something, you know, just like little dishes that you can pick up for like $3. And yeah, so you just walk around and you get, oh, that looks good. A curry sausage. Sure. Okay, now I'll have some weird potato chips, and now I'll have this and that. And before you know it, you weigh 10 pounds more than you did.
But hey, look, but that's the point. That's if you don't like those things are that. All right. Switching topics, we're talking about this in the pre-show, where we're talking earlier about the fact that, for those who are not watching the video, Bill is wearing an Ash Ketchum hat. If you're not familiar with Ash Ketchum.
Gotta catch them all.
Gotta catch them all. Got it. Ash Ketchum. I forget what it's Satoshi, I think, in Japanese. I think that's his name. I always forget.
I do not know.
Okay. These are only things you learn when you start watching the series of Pokemon, which... I admit I am watching the new Pokemon X, Y, and Z because it's not the greatest anime.
So is my 8-year-old son.
Well, then your 8-year-old son and I will have a lot to talk about. And I'm kidding. It's not the best anime, but hey, look, sometimes you need noise. That being said, we're talking about this in the pre-show. Bill, you've been playing a lot of Pokemon Go, you're mentioning.
I don't want to intimidate anybody, but I'm currently a level 17 Pokemon trainer and I've walked like 60 some miles and I'm catching an Oddish right now. I'm sorry, Roberto. I know
it's okay. No. You catch your, you look, I am never going to deny anyone the, there you go. Did you catch it? The question is this.
I need an Oddish because
hey,
I still, Oddish is one of the ones I haven't evolved.
Well, you just caught it. It just happened.
Ooh, and I have enough to evolve him. Sweet. Actually, you know what? I have evolved the Oddish. He's the Gloom now, and I needed to evolve the Gloom, and now I have enough candy to do so. So
here's the question I'll ask you, and I asked you this the pre-show, and I want you to elaborate on. When is the last time you played a Pokemon game?
Before Pokemon Go?
Before Pokemon Go, yes.
Well, you know what? The last time I played was back in October, because I got them for my son and he wanted me to help him play, so I played for like 20 minutes. But before that I was probably 18.
Wow. 18
years old, so 2000.
Okay, wow. For me, I mean, I played Pokemon X when it came out for 3DS, pretty much. That was like my jam for a while.
See, I in high school we used to, in, because I did theater in high school, and, you know, backstage at the plays, we'd play the card game, kind of like Magic the Gathering, but with Pokemon. And so we'd play that. And then shortly after that, I was into emulators. And so I downloaded all the Game Boy Pokemon games on emulator and played like Red, Yellow, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting for me because, like, my junction point into Pokemon didn't happen until either... It would have to have been either middle school or high school, and it was the Game Boy was still the system of choice whenever it was. So basically, GBA hadn't come out by that. Whenever the GBA came out, that's when it became this. But this is back when Pokemon Silver and I think Gold was the other counterpart to that one.
Yeah,
came out.
Red, gold, red, blue, then gold and silver, I think.
Right. Like, I think it was gold and silver when I started getting in. I forgot what era that came out, so I'm like, am I misspeaking? But I know that I never really got into it. I was like, yeah, okay, cool. It wasn't until someone said, here, try out the game, and I realized, oh, it's a JRPG. Cool. And that was all I needed. Was all I needed was this JRPG aspect to it.
Yeah.
And it became apparent that the gotta catch 'em all sort of part, the portion of like catch all these Pokemon, never bit me. Never became part of my like playing style, because even up to X and Y, because I played that one. I played the 64. I played the original DS one, the 2D one. Not Black and White or any of the other ones that came out for it. But when X and Y came out and I started playing again, and I rarely switched out my main. I rarely changed my team up. I kind of just kept it the same. And once I caught like the legendary Pokemon for that respective game, that was it. That was basically like, all right, well, you're part of the team now. Cool. Cause you're the big hitter. And I would just sort of jam through it. And it was apparent, like, I'm not catching a lot of Pokemon, because I don't really care to, not because it's a bad thing, but just like, it's such the annoying part of like finding where they're fucking at and doing this. Like, I think the limit I did for X was that like, I wanted a Ditto, if nothing more, to cop to breed things easier.
Yeah.
Basically the point where it ended.
Yeah. That was always kind of my strategy too, was just to have like, you know, one or two guys or whatever, and just build them up a lot. And I've been running into frustration playing Pokemon Go, just because you really can't do that, because it's kind of counterintuitive to the game. There are gym battles and stuff, but if you could be out playing Pokemon Go and run into another Pokemon Go player and battle your Pokemon against them, I think that playing style would work a lot better.
Yes. And that's been the one thing that I realized when that wasn't there. I was like, when Pokemon Go came out, I was like, okay, cool. I realized what this game is supposed to be. I realized what part of the Pokemon experience it's fulfilling, mm-hmm. and why it's popular. It just became this like, you're not part of the Pokemon experience that I played. You're not the JRPG aspect. You're not that. And we're talking about this pre-show. I'll talk about it now. I do think it's such a great example of IP and how important that is to a game versus almost anything else. This is almost it's the Pokemon Go game for a lot of things is pretty much Ingress. Like, it's pretty much that. There's a couple of key differences, and those key differences are like, well, you throw Pokeballs at Pokemon to catch them. That's like, yeah, that's Pokemon. Of course those are there. Because even when the game kicks up, you know, it's like, hi, I'm Professor, insert tree name here. Yeah. You know, the world of Pokemon is a magical world where humans, it's like, I've read all this before. I've seen this how many times? Professor Oak's told me this. Sycamore's told me this. Fuck, every goddamn professor's told me this shit. You know, what more can you tell me about this? It was such a weird thing of like kicking up the game and just like, I know the story. I'm well aware of what Pokemon are. It's like, oh, that's right. This is for people who don't know what Pokemon is.
It's really funny because my wife, who is not a Pokemon fan at all, in fact kind of anti-Pokemon because my son likes it so much and he talks about it all the time, but you know, she picked up this game and she's all about it, and we talk a lot about the game, and so she'll be saying, you know, I just leveled up Squirtle and now I'm looking for Bulbasaur, and she's like, what the fuck am I doing with my life?
That's the danger point, I think, of any kind of geek property. Is when you get to the point where you question, what the fuck am I doing? Because you think about any of the other ridiculous games that you've played over the years, like because you're now at an, you know, like, you and I are both of ages where we can question ourselves and ask, what the hell are we doing with our life?
Yeah,
when it comes to silly things like, and everything. I say silly things. Well, when I say silly things like Pokemon, not saying that Pokemon's silly, but just it's like in the grand scheme of things, Pokemon isn't necessarily the greatest of.
You know, it's me though. All these old bastards who are complaining about it. They're like, these kids and their Pokemon Go. And I've even heard a lot of people say, I would rather the kid was inside playing a video game than outside playing Pokemon Go. What are you talking about, dude? Like, no, if nothing else, they're getting out there. They're moving. People are talking to each other. And you want to lock him in a room with a TV.
You know what? It's so funny. I think the weird influx is, and there was a really cool and for a while there's really cool, like during the beginnings of it, a really cool thing that came out of BBC Five Live is their like their talk radio thing. And and since I work kind of weird hours, I typically listen to Five Live just because they're the only ones that are actually broadcasting something interesting. At like, you know, 4 a.m. When it's like already 10 a.m. there. And there was a report of the British, like some of the British churches, I forget what the Church of England is, where they were like having being welcome saying, you know what? Come on, kids, come catch Pokemon here, you know, and that, and kind of talking about that. And they would use it not as it was sort of this weird thing of like, they were using it as, I mean, yes, to a certain bit of outreach, try to get people back to the church and stuff like that, but also B, the idea of embracing that here is a bunch of people kind of coming into this, into our landscape, into our world physically, and sort of embracing saying like, yeah, of course you're welcome, and having this interaction like, well, you know, what'd you catch? Oh, I got this. Oh, that's awesome. And while yes, they could say like, because the one thing that's sort of that certain people are doing, and I kind of wish more people would do it because only certain people are doing it, is I wished that when it came to Pokemon Go, people would go look around as like where they're at in the world. Like they're not just like, I caught a Squirtle, cool, boop, boop, boop. Not like, I caught a Squirtle, wait, where the hell am I? And kind of look around because like, wow, I didn't realize this awesome piece of artwork was here. It's like, wow, this is a really cool statue. What is this here? You know, what is Steve Ray Vaughan doing as a statue here? Like, who is Steve? You know, if you don't know who that kind of thing is, or at least in Austin, that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, because I even remember like during the beginnings, like the National Park Service, I think there was a really cool Facebook post that got shared where it was at the Washington Memorial. It was like, you know, like all these singers and Jigglypuff. And they like someone had caught a Jigglypuff there at the Washington Memorial, took a picture of it. It was just sort of this funny moment. It's like, yeah, I guess Jigglypuff would be a singer. And that's kind of funny that they're embracing this and sort of being silly with it. Because if you're, you know, I say silly being like, yeah, Jigglypuff and is on the level of Paul McCartney as singers. It's like, but it's cool. It was a cool thing to see a lot of these places that don't mind people coming to sort of embrace that.
Yeah, like what I don't get, and I was just saying before, is that people who are like, oh, I don't play Pokemon Go because I got shit to do. I got to go watch sports and this, that, and the other. I'm like, at least people are out there and they're active, and they're active within the community again, which is something like, you know, that we've kind of been losing a lot as a society. And I think, I don't know, very heartening to me. I feel very optimistic about Pokemon Go.
Well,
what it says about society and where it's moving.
Well, because you bring up the like, I have important things to do, like watch sports, and it's such a funny thing when it comes to fandoms in general. And we could and you could probably talk about this as a guy that does a lot of podcasts for various fandoms over the time and stuff like that. So you've interacted with a good chunk of like different subsects of fandoms. You know, I kind of only interact with so many, but you know, you have that sort of advantage on me. Where if you start analyzing all the fandoms, you know, whether it be comic books, movies, or otherwise, they're all roughly the same. They're all these like very passionate people about something.
Yeah, and they're all the same types are in every fandom. Like the people who are shippers are in every fandom, and the people who are more about analyzing the story are in every fandom, and the people are way, way too into the story.
Those are my favorite. The people who are way too, who read too much into it. Like, I love those. I love those ones because they're the ones that will look like I think the one I am dangerously getting close to being way too into things. And it occurred to me about, I'd say a week ago that I was getting that dangerous close was Mr. Robot.
Oh, Mr. Robot.
Well, because like I, you know, my day job is InfoSec. Like I work in that world. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, and I watch it, you know, I'm not watching it tonight because it's playing right now or something like that, but I'm watching it tomorrow when it comes out of Amazon. I have the ability to pause the screen at that, you know, kernel dump, at that hack attempt, at that sort of thing. And I'll pause it. And the thing is that, and I won't spoil what's happened so far, but last week's episodes were revealed something crazy. If you're not watching Mr. Robot, you should be. It's interesting because the IP addresses that are mentioned in certain parts of other hacks, if you had gone to those IP addresses, they resolved to something that would have given you a clue and a hint. And I didn't learn that until reading the subreddit, because my mind was kind of exploded, blown, because I wouldn't even think of that.
Sometimes they'll even put stuff in there. They'll like have Elliot put in a certain amount of commands, and then you can go to the Mr. Robot website and load a fake terminal and put them in. And they'll send you like t-shirts and hoodies and stuff too.
Yeah, once I learned that there's a Mr. Robot terminal, like I tweeted about this, that I was like, I got to the point where I was decoding a fake fucking kernel panic. A goddamn fake kernel panic. I was fucking decoding a kernel, like, this shit crashed, the seg fault. I was fucking decoding that to try to find some glimmer, some glimpse of something. And I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, it came not even in like a bad way, but just in a like, God damn it, what am I doing with this show? I'm decoding this. I'm staring at QR codes. I'm looking at hex numbers for something totally not, I'm not saying important per se, but just like I could be focusing this time on something else. It became apparent. I was just like, this is the show for me. It's getting dangerous, because I'm like, because it's so connected to a world I know, that I'm like, okay. I see where you're hiding stuff. And now that they've been revealing that they've been hiding stuff in that, it's like, fuck. Now I'm going to pay attention even more.
Elliot has always been an unreliable narrator, and that held true in the second season. Although I will say that for the first few episodes of the second season, I was kind of uneven on it. I was like, it seems like really slow and everything's disconnected, and it doesn't seem like much of anything is happening to the main plot. But then they had their too many cooks moment.
Which I enjoyed that moment a ton, and it made so much sense when you realized. So okay, I'm gonna put it right here, because we gotta talk about this. We gotta talk about this episode specifically. This episode isn't. I mean, it's an important episode. So if you have yet to watch season two of Mr. Robot, we're about to spoil one episode to a certain degree. We'll skip ahead, maybe 10 or so minutes, and if you hear me say anything, like I'll make sure to put another audio warning as to when. We'll put in the show notes, hopefully, when this begins, when this ends, so you guys can completely and utterly avoid it. But if you have yet to watch season two, and I apologize for watching live, but I've got to talk about this, because it's such a good episode of Mr. Robot. I don't think it won't be too bad. I'll do my best to sort of dance around everything.
We don't do spoiler warnings on our show. We're like,
I have to, because this is not a spoilerific topic. This is. Typically, this podcast doesn't talk about, you know.
We don't do spoiler warnings. We do spoiler parties, entire episodes.
This is where a complete spoiler thing of like Mr. Robot discussion. Like, yeah, everything's fair game, but because it's a sub, you get what I'm trying to say, Bill. I'm trying to make sure I don't get the comments like, well, you didn't warn me about this.
Alf was on Mr. Robot.
What's up?
I said what you're trying to say is that Alf was on Mr. Robot.
Yes,
Alf was on Mr. Robot.
What was interesting about that episode, when that episode began and I realized what they were doing, I knew immediately, like, oh, we're in Elliot's happy place. We're in Elliot's mind. This is his mind trying to protect him from whatever the fuck just happened. Which I was like, I immediately was on board. I caught on like 5 minutes and I was like, huh. Now, I didn't know about the live broadcast that they had like put like old 90s ads, which that's in fucking insane.
Yeah, I didn't see that either, because I'm like you. I'm watching it, you know, after the fact, where there are no commercials in it. But yeah, I guess they had old Budweiser ads and stuff like that on it.
That's insane. That's a level to commitment that I have never seen out of television.
You know what else I read about it that I thought was pretty incredible? The theme song was written by the person who wrote the theme song for Full House, Family Matter.
Yeah, I recognize the voice. I recognize the voice without even going into full. Like I heard the voice. I go, like, that's the same person that sung those themes. I don't know that person's name per se, but I was like, I knew exactly what it was. And again, what they were implying was interesting, because again, it clicked with me right away that this is Elliot's happy place. Something just fucking happened. Something hardcore fucking happened. And lo and behold, you learn it did. That this is where his brain is putting him, because it's safe area. It's and I was like, and it came very apparent to me that that's what I'm doing. And I like how Elliot was just like,
do you have any ideas on why that in particular was a safe area?
My theory is, and I have an idea, and it comes from sort of being part of that generation. I'm not saying my parents weren't cautious. Of course they were, and we talked and I had a good conversation with that. But a lot of our nostalgia, a lot of our moments in life when we go back, when we regress back, when you have people that are sort of sad, it's sort of the weird thing of like now everyone's sort of looking back nostalgically at certain things and saying like, oh, it was so much better then. I have a feeling that that's where Elliot, you know, knowing the family relationship between his father and his mother and then, you know, subsequent disease and everything else, because in the series, you know, it becomes apparent that like all that bleeds, you know, Alpha's there because the TV's on and that's sort of coming in that way. But that doesn't explain the 90s narrative. That doesn't explain like why is Elliot's safe place a 90s sitcom?
Well, see, my thought was that where they reveal Elliot is in last week's episode, where he's been the entire time, in that sort of environment, the only thing you can really, they'll really let you watch is safe TV, like that old sick. I mean, even his friend, all he talks about is Seinfeld.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the nostalgia is probably part of it, but I think more of it has to do with the fact that that's really the only, not digital, but sort of electronic input he's getting. And, you know, he feeds off of that. So when it comes time to create a safe place, whatever's been being that pushed into his brain is what he's going to use.
That might be true. I almost took it more as the idea of, because there's a really good write-up, I think, on IndieWire. I think it might have been IndieWire. I forget where it was. Where they're talking about that episode because it's such a, it's like Alf's there. It's like, what the fuck's Alf doing? I haven't seen Alf in years. What is Alf doing? Like, why do we have enough Alf? And that kind of thing. I took it as this is the place that, you know, as us kids kind of grew up in that era, even though we're, you know, agriculture's weird. We all kind of different things. We all have sort of similar markers. The idea that we all watched ABC Family, you know, whether we wanted to or not, it's just that's what was on. There was nothing, you know. Yeah.
And it wasn't like now where everything's available to everyone and everyone can watch something. It was very few things were available to everybody, so everybody watched the same 10 things.
And even with cable, it wasn't like it is now where it's like you have 500 channels of, you know, garbage. You could watch. You know, there are channels dedicated to, you know, I mean, the joke has always been, you know, with Weird Al was that there was like the cable was this wonderful world where channels were that. And it's like, no, not really, unless you paid like hyper premiums. Now it is that world. Now it's like, sure, there's a bowling channel because fuck it. We have bandwidth to spare. What else are we going to do? You know, like, sure, you can have those small niche channels.
You want a 20-hour series based around the wife of the Atom from DC Comics? Sure. There's one out there on YouTube, probably.
Right. Well, YouTube, even, and the internet's even more so. But so what I liked about that is that era, you know, TGIF, you know, and I say that one just as ABCs because that to me felt like what they're aping because like Full House, Family Matters, that kind of thing.
Oh, definitely.
That was the thing to watch. And that was the thing that was on. And that was what everybody watched, you know, for whatever reason. And it wasn't necessarily, no offense to Full House, you know, I wouldn't call it the pinnacle of television. I wouldn't call it necessarily, I'm not saying it's not a bad show, but just, I wouldn't say it's like, well,
there's, you know, my three favorite series and I'll list these in reverse order. Number three, Fargo. Number two, Breaking Bad. Number one, Full House. I mean, it's just, you never knew what was going to happen. You never knew what Comet was going to do. Was Comet going to pull the stuffing out of the couch? And I mean, was Michelle going to take some scissors and cut Uncle Jesse's hair while he was sleeping? And then what would Uncle Jesse do? I mean, you never knew what was going to happen with those guys.
What is that guy doing? What is Uncle Jesse doing these days?
John Stamos? Well, one, he's producing Fuller House.
Right.
He had a show on NBC that got canceled called Grandpa or Young Grandpa or
that's
something.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know, he gets work. He used to be married to a supermodel. He's not anymore, but
the guy that I think fell off the face of the planet after that, and I say that jokingly because I don't know what the fuck this guy's doing. What the hell is Dave Coulier doing these days?
Dave Coulier, well, I saw him on Fuller House, and before that, the only thing I had seen him in was a web series, and kind of a meta web series called Can't Get Arrested, where he played himself, and he couldn't get work, and he was trying to create controversy in the tabloid so he could get a job again.
Oh, my God. I would love... Okay, you know what? I now want to watch that because I have now like insane respect for Dave Coulier for pulling that kind of meta stuff off. That makes me at least way more curious on his humor now. Because like
a lot of the Full House people are in it too. Like Jodie Sweetin is like the co-star, and Saget and Stamos. Well, because
like Bob Saget, like out of all the people, the only reason I said like what is Bob, I don't question what Bob Saget is doing. I know what the fuck he's doing. He's doing like actually decent comedy, and he's always been a funny guy, you know, like yes, he was always the family person in Full House and became the guy for, you know, for America's Funniest Home Videos. But like Bob Saget, I always remember like the moment I became wise to who he was on Half Baked, was when he's like, I used to suck dick for Coke. I was like, wow, Bob Saget, this is already, we're in a moment of where it needs to be. Like I had like my respect level just like rose, just like, okay, that's the real Bob Saget here, the, you know, sucking, you know, as a joke, you know, sucking dick for Coke. You ever suck dick for marijuana? It was such a, you know, a great beat because again, it's like he still said it. And, you know, you look at his stand up comedy, it's pretty funny and it gets, you know, somewhat edgy at times and, you know, appropriately edgy, I say.
Somewhat.
Like, okay. Maybe a lot more edgy. But he's a cool guy. And so I knew what he was doing. It was just like everybody else was like, well, I guess Stamos is doing whatever. And I had no idea what Coulier is doing. But now I want to see the meta web series. That sounds far more fascinating than Fuller House.
Have you watched Fuller House?
No, I have not.
It's actually pretty good.
Okay.
It surprised me. At first I was like, okay, this is going to be like the sequel to Boy Meets World, Girl Meets World, where it's kind of...
Sorry, go ahead.
It's going to be the same premise, but it's going to be all modernified and awful. You know, not modern in a good way, but modern in a this is how they make sitcoms now kind of way. But... Fuller House, I thought it just hit all the right notes. It felt like the old show, but it had a lot of kind of like very subtle adult humor that only people who watched the original show would get. But you could still sit down and watch it with your kids, and there was a lot of meta humor in it too. Like a lot of Olsen twins jokes because they wouldn't do it, you know. Like at one point, someone goes out and buys a dress for a wedding, and they're like, oh, yeah, this is a Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen original. And then someone looks at the price tag, and no wonder they stopped acting.
That's great. No, it's funny because, I did not watch it, but I'm trying to think where I did, however, watch, because it was on Netflix, I watched an episode of Girl Meets World, and
That was awful.
It's so funny when you start to realize what the Disney sitcom formula is, and then you watch, you know, that kind of thing, and just like, wow, this is the Disney sitcom formula at its finest, and it's so garbage. It's like it's garbage on a level that I'm just like, this is not even remotely funny, and
like Girl Meets World, it's a factory sitcom. Fuller House. People cared about what they were doing on that show.
Okay, you might have sold me on it. You might have just convinced me to watch. I mean, there's other things I need to watch. I just recently finished up Stranger Things on Netflix.
Solid program.
Pretty solid, for sure. They'll be... There's hope. There's something coming down the pipeline where me and Brant talk about it. I don't know when it'll come out, so I don't want to say kind of when, but it's coming down the pipeline.
No, soon. No, commit to a date right now, here.
I can't because Brant's editing the video.
I can't
because if it were up to me and I were editing, I could commit to date and then I'd follow it. But because of Brant editing the video, I can't commit for him. It'd be like me saying Bill Meeks will write his next book in a week and a half.
Okay, so I'm writing a book in a week and a half. And when's Brant editing together the Stranger Thing talk?
I have no idea. I can't tell you. It'll come soon. That's all I can say. Only because I don't want to put Brant in anything. But we did film stuff for Cinematography for it, and it should be coming out of the pipeline, along with some other stuff we filmed too as well. But regardless of that, like I think out of all the things of the series I enjoyed the most, I think I might have enjoyed the soundtrack more than anything else.
Oh yeah, the soundtrack was it was straight 80s.
Well, only because like that, like it's funny when you look at the 80s as a whole, much like any other era as a whole. where that movie's where that movie. I keep saying movie every time I talk about it because it feels like a goddamn film.
It's super cinematic. It feels like a 80s Spielberg movie.
Well, what's great about it, and I do talk about this in the thing, is that like for me, it did everything. Like I wasn't the biggest fan of Super 8, you know, the J.J. Abrams film. Like I thought it did some things wrong, whereas I felt Stranger Things did everything right that Super 8 did wrong. And I know it's weird to compare those. Like, how do I compare a movie to a series? But they're such in the same vein that it's just like I can do that.
You know? Do you want to know some trivia about Super 8?
Sure.
I've never seen it actually, but it was shot in a town called Weirton, West Virginia, which is about half an hour from where I went to college. So I've been there a ton. And it's also where my wife's family, a lot of her family lives. And they actually, for Super 8, they shot a decent amount of it in my wife's aunt's electronics store. Not really like electronics, but like light bulbs, light fixtures. Right. So they shot several scenes in that store and around that store. So
I would say you should watch it, Bill, only because I'd be curious as to your take on it.
I definitely want to see it, just if nothing else. I know the town so well that it would be cool to just be like, oh, that's where, you know, I hung out with Brett or that one time.
Well, because the only real issue I had with Stranger Things and it's the same thing I had with Super 8. It's in that weird portion of the 80s and set in the weird portion of the 80s where it's like we're just barely getting out of the 70s aesthetic and we're not quite in what's known as the 80s aesthetic yet. And I think
I don't know. I don't feel like for most of America that really happened until like 87, 88. Because I mean, I wasn't cognizant for most of the 80s, but by around like 85 or so, I was pretty aware of stuff, and I feel like there was a lot of that 70s aesthetic, really was the 80s aesthetic, but it wasn't the 80s on TV aesthetic. It was just like the real life aesthetic.
Right. No, that's why I still enjoyed a good. Again, I have nothing against that series. It's like it's the aesthetics always bugged me. I've always hated that part of the 80s. I've always hated like the faux wood and the. I mean, again, the Atari is a great example of what if you ever want to know what the 80s aesthetic was, just look up Atari 2600 picture, and that's the fucking birth child of this like weird faux wood kind of bullshit thing.
Yeah. One thing that kind of bugs me about when people talk about this series is and I mean, we did it too, but they always start off with that nostalgic factor. And I think, you know, strip all the nostalgia stuff away, it's just a really well-made sci-fi horror mystery comedy. You know, I think you could set that in modern day, and if it was done by the same creators, it would be just as good.
Oh no, and that's why I think that's what got me into it was that I enjoyed a lot of, and I'm being vague about it, so it's not spoil anything this one, but I enjoyed a lot of. I mean, there's the things that bugged me, and it's so funny. The things that bugged me were the things of like. Yeah, I get it's the 80s, and I get that's your default villain of the 80s, but we don't need to have that there. Like it was those weird moments of like of when it made itself apparent that this is the 1980s in very specific ways, like bringing up the Russians or the Cold War or anything like that. And it's like, I know what you're doing, and I know why you're doing it, but and it was but it was all those nostalgic moments that bugged me. But when it came to the series, and it came to like this. You know, this girl and all these kind of different things that just kind of came up. I was like, that's fucking cool. And I love the aesthetic. I love the way they did the effects of certain things. I love the creature design. The creature design for that thing was phenomenal. We'll just
except for maybe the last scene it appeared in when it was fully lit and everything. I didn't think it
looked. I always loved the face. The face was like my favorite part of that creature. Cause it looked like just something when I first saw. I was like, Jesus. I was like, yeah. I was like, damn. I was like, okay, that's hard. I mean, again, it's still CG, and I could tell, but it was just like, if I saw that in a dark alley, I think I'd scream, and you know, I just want to slit my throat now.
Who was your favorite human character?
I have two.
Okay.
And I always seem to default to this kind of interaction. I don't know why. I, you know, any series you ask me about, I tend to default to these kind of things. I loved Mike and I loved Eleven.
Mm-hmm.
I love the interaction between the two of them. I always default to that. I always default to this, like, the weird lead character, maybe because he was a DM and I've DM'd before. Maybe it's because he was the one that no matter how crazy things got, he seemed to sort of keep a calm head, even though things that, and I always liked the fact that he kind of believed more and sort of was a little bit more open to things.
Yeah. See, a lot of people say 11, and I mean, the actress did fine. But I think it was really more about, her presence there was very powerful. I don't think I didn't feel like they gave her a lot to work with. I mean, she had some extreme emotions, but there wasn't really a lot of subtlety to her character. So I don't know. She didn't impress me as much. I did really like, I can't remember the kid's name.
Which one?
The kid, you know, the one who was missing the teeth and everything.
Oh, God, you know, I have I just so happened to have, because we've recorded things. I have an article with all the characters on there. So let me tell you really quick. Where is my,
I think it starts with a D.
Yeah, I'll tell you right now.
Like Duncan or something.
Yeah, something like that. I just want it all notes. It is Dustin.
Dustin. No, but he was bar none my favorite character.
I did between Dustin. The other between like Mike and Eleven's interactions, I loved. I also enjoyed Lucas, only because like I love the idea of the characters. Just like, I don't believe any of this, and then when things hit the fans, like, oh shit, all this is real. I always love the moment of just like having those characters like, fuck, everything's real. What do I do now? Because like, it's such a those moments are so funny to have.
Yeah. That Winona Ryder did a really good job too.
Like, she did phenomenal. Like, and that's kind of the one thing. Like, I think everyone did great in some form of fashion. I agreed. Winona Ryder. I've since learned she apparently doesn't have Twitter or any social kind of media stuff.
Oh, really?
I guess, yeah, only because I was reading some articles on this like after the show's done, because it was like, apparently her and Millie Brown, the girl that played Eleven, like did some ops and interviews and whatnot. And they both like have a relationship in terms of as much as an adult and a kid can have a relationship in terms of like talking, and acting. And it's so funny because like she'll be her like be Winona's, and I think she even had a nickname for her, be her sort of element of like what the greater world is talking about when it comes to this. Because again, Winona Ryder, I mean, like, she's been, I haven't seen her perform in something in a long, long time. I don't exactly.
Well, she got in trouble for shoplifting with like 10 years ago or something, kind of fell off the map in a lot of ways. I think she just has mainly stuck to like indie projects and stuff since then.
Yeah. It's definitely a weird thing, but I'm definitely, I dug it. Bill, we have hit the hour mark.
We've
gone over the hour mark, but that's neither here nor there, because You know how that this is what we do, Bill. This is how we roll.
Yeah.
Bill Meeks, you know, and if there's anything you want to talk about that we didn't talk about, you know what I say, right?
What? What do you say?
I'll just have to get you back on again.
Okay.
That's and I won't make it this long this time. I keep saying that, but I know you're busy, and it's always a like.
Yeah, but then it's always longer the next time. So you're like, oh, it's not going to be that long. Add 2 months to the last time period.
Bill Meeks, thank you so much for being on. Tell people where they can, if they want to hear more of you talk about all this fandom stuff, all this weird, you know, nerdy stuff from Lost to, you know, all the other things you talk about. I don't know if you're still doing Gotham podcast. I know you're doing.
We that. Are.
Okay. I know you're doing like the We're So Lost, and you're doing like that sort of, you know, fun escapade of a show.
Yeah, because me and my wife have/slash co-host Amory have never seen Lost before, so we're watching it through as if it's airing for the first time. No spoilers, none of that, and we're kind of analyzing it and theorizing about it. It's We're So Lost, WeSoLost.com. And, you know, we have the Legends of Gotham podcast. We're going to be restarting our other podcast, Universe Box. We're kind of relaunching it as more of a news show, sort of a more of a topical show. Before, it was all set to a theme, like we would do an episode on fear, and we would have several segments about fear, and people would write in stories about fear. We're going to make it a little simpler, twice a week, half an hour. We're going to talk movies, TV, music, and books. It's going to be Universe Box. We're going to relaunch it with the same name, and we'll be starting that this Friday, actually. And you can check out all that and everything else we do at universebox.com. I'll also say we did a live stream table read for my pilot Infinite Tina. I highly recommend you check it out, infinitetina.com.
Yeah, for sure.
Follow me on Twitter at Bill Meeks.
I also hope one day you bring back the what was it you did, the internet one? Was it this old internet?
Old Wide Web.
Yes, I want that to come back.
I have most of a book written for that. I need to polish it. I did release one chapter, the Bird is Evil chapter. That's up on Amazon and Audible and all those sites if you ever want to check it out.
Yeah, that's also something to promote too. You want to, Bill Meeks has a slew of not just books on Amazon, but like Audible, you know, honest to God, like, and I say like honest to God, Audible, but like, no, I mean like actually legitimate, like, readers that are not friends of ours. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I have SAG members who have read Trials of King Sparrow for me. You just go to Audible or Amazon and search for Bill Meeks books. It's the Dog Boy Adventures series and Trials of King Sparrow and Bird is Evil and more to come.
For sure. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 there on the Twitters. If you want to catch previous episodes of this podcast, you can head to our website, cosmicradio.tv/8bitlife. There are fun links to show notes. Our Twitter account, which is at 8BitLifePodcast, and of course, other things around this network. And after you've bought all of Bill Meeks' books and supported all his podcasts and done all the things, and you look in your pocket, and you're like, well, I got $5 left over. Head over to patreon.com/8BitLife and help this podcast become bigger, better, and more awesomer. So that's it for today. Next time, take two. Let me talk to another geek. Wow, this is the first time I think this is the first time in a long time I flubbed on that exit. Which is fun to do.
I put a jinx on you.
It's like it could be worse. So that's it for today. Until next time, we'll talk to another geek about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people. This has been a CosmicRadio.tv audio production. For more awesome shows, head on over to our website, CosmicRadio.tv.